The theme of this residency has been embracing this life. And last week I was focusing embracing this life with the theme of cultivating a living practice. And now, this evening, I'd like to reflect on the role of noble kindness in embracing this life and in developing a living practice, a truly living practice, not a theoretical practice, not an ideological practice, but something that we live with and breathe with and share with others. Noble kindness is metta. I brought the word noble into the reference because of the fact that metta dignifies our human nature. And in fact, it reminds us that we are kindred, that we are not separate, in a very unique way that I'll explore a little bit. Because it brings us back in touch with the deepest inherent tenderness that is true of all beings. I also use the term noble in reference to the noble truths, in particular to the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, because metta is essential to beginning to embrace ourselves and our experience in a way that allows for us to bring kindness, kind attention to the experience of our own suffering. In fact, there's a kind of prerequisite associated with this. Without kindness, then we tend to be in an adversarial attitude and relationship to our own suffering. This is our habitual process. We begin to see suffering as suffering. We begin to resent it. We begin to recognize how afraid we are of it. We begin to wish that it were otherwise. And we don't really know how to allow it to come into play and to actually fulfill the role that suffering will fulfill on this path of practice. And there's a kind of interesting discovery here that as we begin to allow for a sense of a kind receptivity to our own suffering, then that removes the barrier and allows suffering to become the very basis for the inspiration for practice. In fact, without actually having conceptualized it or maybe seen it as a part of your conscious perspective, this is effectively what motivates us to practice. Suffering motivates us to practice. We don't come to practice because we're saying life is such an extraordinary joy and I'm fulfilled in all ways at all times, and that I'm in a pleasant state and I have the perfect friends and partner and job, and you know, that isn't the way that we perceive life. Although we occasionally meet somebody who provides that portrayal. And it's very, of course, compelling. We see dramatizations that kind of fool us at times, that there are some people that do not suffer. But there's a kind of wisdom that can see through the experience of portrayals when one begins to see the universal experience of one's own suffering. Metta in particular addresses the suffering of ill will and fear. And at this point what I'd like to do is focus a little bit on a quality that is kindred to metta, and that is the quality of patience. And I'd like to focus on patience and reflect on patience because of the fact that there actually isn't, it cannot be, the cultivation or the fulfillment of the intention to cultivate mindfulness, or metta without patience. Because the mind is so restless in its preoccupations, its preoccupation with how it should be, its preoccupation with what it wants, what it doesn't want, its preoccupation with the past, the future. It's meandering. It's said in the Dhammapada that the mind, when not conditioned by mindfulness, is just like a fish out of water, flip-flopping. And there's a compassion that I feel as I say this, that the process of the conditioned mind is a process where it is in and of itself looking for that which already exists. And there's a kind of tragedy with that. It is so consumed by the separate sense of self, so much looking at life from the point of view of what isn't, rather than what is, that it just continues to cultivate a sense of deprivation. And of course, unconsciously, out of that arises the issue of blame. You know, now who's to blame? Is it the government? Is it our ex-president? Is it my best friend, you know, who disappointed me? I mean, who's to blame? Who's to blame for this suffering? And I might add this existential suffering. The suffering that comes with existence. The sense of angst. This uncomfortable sensation. Who's to blame for this? Well, oftentimes there's a storehouse of self-blame associated with what's referred to as ignorance or as a lack of understanding that grows with an appreciation of cause and effect. But anyway, the mind is just in and of itself kind of meandering and wandering and confused because it can't find its way. And what's common here and what's fortuitous, auspicious here amongst us in this room is that somehow in this kind of darkening plane of struggle and flight, a little bit of light emerged somewhere along the way. A little bit of light that drew our attention, even though it might not have been a conceptual experience, but a little bit of light that lifted our minds out of that confusion and began a process where the mind became inclined towards what I might refer to as present time awareness. It's such an extraordinary moment when one has the understanding, whether it's something that one has heard or if it just is an intuitive movement within oneself of recognition, that there is something called present time awareness. In a certain way, it resolves instantaneously all the issues that are present in the mind, not that they don't live on past that point, but there's a sense of hope that comes with the sense of now. Because what it does is it provides a kind of stabilizing actuality that puts our preoccupation with the past and the future in perspective for a moment. So there's a lot of restlessness in the unconscious conditioned process in life. And it's the quality of patience that is actually the antidote or the way of working with this restlessness that arises out of wanting. I realized one time when I was in retreat that every form of distraction was some form of wanting. And it became very easy then to just note every form of distraction as wanting itself, you know, before it kind of proliferated into what it wanted and also the other side of that coin, which is what it didn't want, and got into an aversive state. So patience is that process that can slow things down a little bit so that there's a little bit more reflective power in the mind. Because one of the unique qualities of our human nature and our human perception, separate and different from other creatures, is that we are able to recognize and experience objectively. And patience is what allows for that sense of being able to be with the restless energy of the mind that moves so quickly from the uncomfortable sensations associated with that towards anger. So patience is the counterbalancing quality and contemplative practice, something that we can grow through intention as a way to bring space and to bring acceptance to our existential experience of restlessness and the underlying pain in our existence, because anger is so much just a reaction to that which is uncomfortable. I had this really interesting experience. I think I mentioned it on, I've taught a number of times since I've been here, but I think I mentioned it last Saturday here in Albuquerque during the day long. But I think it was actually that morning, I'm not sure anyway, that I got into the car to drive here. But anyway, I got into the car, and there was just another car that kind of passed before me on this dirt road. And it was a red kind of Jeep car. And there was a woman sitting in this car driving it, and she had on glasses. Was anybody at the day long last Saturday? Do you recognize this story? No? Okay. So, and there was this instantaneous moment of aversion. And the conditioned mind said, I don't like her. Now, the objective capacity said, what? You don't know her? You know, so it was a real interesting moment of awareness, juxtaposition, in a juxtaposition with irrationality. But the ability to see that what it was that had arisen was just a sense of a feeling kind of restless and a little bit angry. And so I just sat there in the car and allowed for it to kind of play itself through. And suddenly I became aware that I had felt kind of like where I'm staying in the casita is a very lovely place, but we've left the chairs out for the group that comes on Wednesday, whomever wishes to come, and there's a big table in between the couch, and I was sort of knocking around and hitting corners, you know, one of those days. And it just kind of set a sense of aversion going. And so by the time I got outside, you know, there it was, expressing itself in this ridiculous manner. I mean, actually, it was a kind of cute car. And I'm sure the woman was just a perfectly fine individual. But there was that sense, you know, of how quickly it is that restlessness and anger arise and project into life. And if it weren't for the inherent patience associated with the practice of mindfulness, then that would have been a moment of delusion that kind of proliferated into other moments of aversion. Because when the mind is in a state of anger, when anger has arisen, then that's the filter through which one sees life. And anger, as well as other states, are constantly rising like weather conditions. You know, one can say, I prefer sun, but that doesn't mean it's always going to be sunny. I mean, there are some places I understand that you can move where it's probably predominantly sunny. You can do that, but it's very expensive to move. you know, generally, you know, one can say, I prefer this or that, but that isn't the basis from which actuality, you know, takes any kind of solid form. It's unreliable. But because we have these standards and these preferences, then we tend to be in a grump more than we realize. Patience allows for us to slow things down, to pause, to be interested in actually what's going on, and to begin to see the distinction between the conditioned mind and the constantly changing weather conditions, states arising and passing away, some pleasant, some unpleasant, some wholesome, engendering a sense of wholeness, and others fragmenting. And to really become, as I mentioned to you, familiar with this truth of change, this characteristic of change, and to become a little bit more sensitive to the fact that with each arising state, anger, then there is this filter again through which we are going to perceive the world, and how we perceive something is then how we process it. And as well, with each state, there's a whole set of sensations that arise in the body. And we begin to see that this is so. We become familiar with this. And as a result of this, there is a slow disengagement of identification with these states. Awareness becomes more efficient as a result of this patience, and begins to see, oh, this is a state, and when the state arises, then these are the thought forms that are characterized. Have you ever noticed that, and you might want to take notice because it's very interesting, that if you are in a state of anger, that there are probably just a sort of predictable set of thoughts that arise in the mind. And when one is really interested, one can see the entire play of the force of anger throughout life and throughout time, right here in one's own mind. One time I was angry at someone. There was an unfortunate kind of process that brought our relationship into compromise. And we had decided not to engage for a while. Ever had that experience? But I would drive by this person's house. Again, I'm in a car. I'm not always in a car. And I would always just kind of provide some metta. But one day I thought, no, let me see what actually arises in the mind if I just stop the car right now and watch my mind and see what occurs in the mind when I pass this house. And it was so very interesting because my mind started to plot a little deadly plan. You know, it was just a kind of spontaneous process by which the mind decided that the very worst thing that I could do to this person was to blow up this person's sailboat. You know, and I'm just sitting here and watching this, you know. And it got very specific about how it would do it. You know, and it just proliferated and proliferated. And there it was, anger and the desire to destroy something, to hurt, to cause pain. That's the nature of anger. It is a reaction to pain that wishes to cause pain. Now, of course, I didn't do that, not yet anyway. And because the interest factor, the patience, actually allows for a quality of purified consciousness to arise. And that which knows and can investigate is purified consciousness. One is safe to inquire, to look into the process of a state, in this case, anger. So patience, just an interest. And then it became kind of humorous. I sort of started to laugh each time I would pass, you know, because of this extraordinary fantasy that arose that I understood also with compassion is something that might have been manifested and is manifested in infinite cases in the mind of delusion, and how extraordinarily sad it is that the only response to pain be anger and retaliation, that there not be another option. So patience allows for interest. It slows things down enough to be able to look into a process and to actually hold the space of the mind and the heart of the situation open to really come forward into the moment and to abide with interest. And within that interest is also neatly tucked in the quality of balance or equanimity, very strongly related. I won't go into it right now, but if I were to go to a list, you know, one of the infinite lists associated with Buddhism, there's this lovely little list, short, associated with the resolve of peace, which is part of our human sense of purpose, to somehow come to the question of peace and find the answer associated with what peace is. And so it said that this resolve of peace is fulfilled by the complete and total cultivation of patience and loving kindness, metta, and equanimity. And this takes a lot of time. Now, of course, this is what our minds tell us we don't have any.
Oh.
And this is the tragic contradiction here. And so we have to choose. We have to choose to believe the mind that says, I have no time and therefore I cannot be patient. Or to understand that actually we have a great deal of time, and to begin to reap it, to harvest it, to begin to use the quality of patience to open up and recognize how much time we do have. It just is that when the mind is in an agitated, restless state, it starts getting very, very focused in surviving and becoming and producing. And all that's very important. I mean, we do need to be mindful of our basic needs and to take good care of ourselves. But restlessness is not a wholesome basis for the evaluation of what our true needs are. And it actually lowers the level of our intelligence. So we get caught up in patterns that belie our deepest intentions. I don't have enough time is a lie that we tell ourselves. So patience is associated with the wisdom of slowing down to begin to see, oh yes, well, there is time. Here's some time. Time exists when we are waiting. How much do we wait? How much are we waiting for? How many situations are we just sort of in a queue, a line? Are we in an office? Are we waiting for a call or whatever? Where there is a pause, but it's not a mindful pause. It's not a fully a pause within one, within which one is fully abiding. But it's again a restless and anticipatory experience where there's something that's supposed to happen but it hasn't happened yet. I have a very clear image when I first started. My parents, for some reason, I can't imagine why, allowed me to start dating when I was 13. I looked more mature or something, I don't know what. I didn't act more mature. But, and I remember when I first started dating and I would wait for my date and I would decide this person would never come, because I couldn't bear the waiting for the last 5 minutes before this person appropriately... People used to behave differently back then. I don't know. I'm really old. But there's this, you know... I mean, people used to arrive on time and meet mothers and, you know, get the sign of approval and be asked where you're going and what you're doing. Of course, that doesn't mean that's what we did. But there was that, you know, that sense, you know, of okay. But I always remember that the waiting itself for this anticipated new experience of dating led to the feeling this would never happen. This person would not come. The waiting was so unbearable. And then there was one time when I met impatience and restlessness again. Later, much later, when I had become an intentional being and was cultivating a practice, as I still am. And there was just that moment when I was waiting for the timer to go off. And I don't know if I've ever experienced quite so much suffering as I was able to experience in that moment when I had decided it was time for the ticker to chime, ding, but meanwhile there were a few seconds left. And this mounting kind of monstrous feeling of impossibility arose. And I remember just reaching over and going, ding, you know, like that. Well, that will take care of it, you know. Now, obviously, the timer was on for a reason, but that didn't matter. There was just that sense I couldn't bear waiting. Patience is something that we can bring to our lives and begin to see where we do have a lot of time that we cannot bear, because actually what we're doing is waiting. And we're waiting for something to happen. And if we began to kind of just make a little list, okay, today I waited 5 minutes here, and da-da-da-da, you know, and maybe just calculate it at the end of the week, one might look and say, oh, I had 3 hours of time. I don't know how long it would be. And I'm sort of making light of it, but one of the actualities that the practice of mindfulness and patience allows for us to work with is the fact that there is time, even though the mind says there is not. The other quality that patience allows for us to begin to bear, and this will sound strange, is the quality of calm. I have found that it's very interesting that, you know, years ago, I would go on a retreat and feel very calm. I'd see somebody and they'd say, oh, you look so rested and kind of expansive. And I'd say, yes, I feel very calm. But then I wouldn't be able to bear it. You know, it would be like, no, 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 no. You know, conditions would take over. And I began to have compassion for that process. That actually, even though there are certain effects of the practice that come as a result of our efforts, that we actually haven't yet found a way of familiarizing ourselves with them and beginning to see how it is that we can maintain them. You know, what is it that can allow for us to actually maintain calm? Because it does exist. It does. And it's very strongly related to patience. Patience will recondition our nervous systems to be able to remain open and still and allow for something to take time. And what that means is to allow something its full experience, its wholeness, its beginning, its middle, and its end. I relate this to just, for instance, the experience of one sensation, you know, associated with the ever-changing sensations moving with one inhalation or exhalation, let's say, you know, at that subtle level. But then at a level that's very poignant, the same principle of allowing that is associated with patience refers to our very life. That patience will allow for us to experience what is left of our lives in a state of openness and receptivity and interest. And these are qualities that actually are not conducive to the causes of suffering. These are qualities that are not suffering. These are qualities that allow for us to work with suffering in a way that actually is dharmically constructive, if that makes sense to you, if I can leave it there. So reflecting on patience related to noble kindness, I've done so because of the fact that actually patience is the prerequisite to kindness. And of course, metta is also cultivated as benevolence or friendship. And I think the most provocative term that is usually used in translation as love. And I tend not to use that translation easily because of the fact that I think it is patience and kindness and benevolence that actually allow for us to begin to understand what love is. We all think that love is a lot of different things that has to do with the fact that when we experience something pleasant, then we tend to feel affection for it. And this can be a human being, it can be a television show, you know, it could be a special kind of bird that we like better than another. And I mean, this is within a relatively wholesome, you know, range where love or affection for something can also, you know, be in realms that are quite unwholesome. It's what draws our attention. Where it is that we actually exact a sense of pleasure. But it's unreliable. I remember my son one time, I was driving somewhere and I had said something and he was maybe 4 years old and he said, "Mommy, you love everything, don't you?" And what he meant was that not that I was an ennobled, you know, awakened being, you know, abiding in a state of loving kindness, but that I use the word love a lot. You know, I love you and I love it and I love them and I, you know, and he was just saying, You love everything, don't you? And I thought, actually, no. No, I hardly love anything. Right now, I love you. That was very cute and funny, and I love you. But it was a real kind of awakening to how glib we are in association with that term. And still, I tend to use it. I like the word lovely. I like to use lovely. It makes me happy to use that word. Makes me happy to use the word love, but I also know that I don't know what it is. So I've backed off from the word love, although I do feel it, into more of an intention to experience kindness and have moved out of the portrayal of kindness, which actually is not it's not authentic kindness, but it's not unwholesome because it's intentional, you know, to pretend kindness. But what I have found helpful, actually, rather than trying to become a kind person myself, you know, and sort of getting caught in portrayal, is to really observe the kindness that does exist. To really become a student of kindness, to see it where it exists, and to see how it feels. And I have found that there is kindness, there is so much kindness as a result of this, that the impatient mind, the mind that is so preoccupied with being kind or whatever, how it looks, how it might become, you know, overlooks. And what happens in that recognition of metta, of kindness, is this extraordinary sense of connection and gratitude. And the most recent example of this that was particularly poignant was that sometimes because of not honoring bodily limitations and the meditation practice, I might add. I have arthritis in my knees. And so when I'm traveling and I'm in one of those airports that just goes on and on and on forever, you know, I will sometimes order a wheelchair in order to get there on time. And coming to Santa Fe, coming to Albuquerque, where was I? San Francisco. And I ordered a wheelchair, and the person who came suddenly behind me and was pushing me along, you know, took me down corridors and across parking lots and outside and up elevators, you know, and into the train and out and into another train. It went on and on forever. You know, it was just like, huh? Yeah. And, you know, and it was really cold. And I noticed that he didn't have a jacket. And I said, oh, you must be really cold. And he said, oh, don't worry, ma'am. You know, I will get you to where you need to be on time. And I just went, oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. You know, and there he was, you know, with this dignity kind of just rolling me along with this sense of a purpose, supported by this warm-hearted kindness. Mm-hmm. And so finally we got to my gate, and he rolled me up, and he said, this is your gate. And I looked at him when he came around, and I said, oh, you are so kind. And he looked at me. It was like, what? I said, you are so kind. Thank you so much for your kindness. I was overwhelmed with his kindness. And then he said, oh, you're welcome. And then he walked away, and he stopped, and he looked again. And suddenly it was like we were looking in the same mirror. His kindness had given rise to that within myself, the recognition of it. And we were just looking in this mirror of kindness, and it was reflecting to him, and it was reflecting back. And then he started to leave again, and then he stopped and looked again, and he did that 3 times. Mm-hmm. It was as if he had never really seen himself in the mirror before. He had never really seen how beautiful he was. And moments like this are such moments of transmission. You know, we think about becoming great beings and transmitting the Dhamma or something, right? but actually, this process is something that exists, and it exists within each of us. And by really becoming aware of the finer qualities within others, then somehow that reflects and strengthens these finer qualities within ourselves. They become stronger. And this mounts on itself, you know, so that acuity to this particular quality that lends itself to affection and to a sense of being kindred increases over time. And what I have found is that, therefore, in that manner, it also gives rise to a sense of compassion when that kindness, that inherent kindness and the inherent sense of connection is disturbed or interrupted by something that is not natural. Kindness is natural to who we are. And that which disturbs it, that which arises out of restlessness, that which leads to harm, is unnatural. I kind of got this little clue from the Dalai Lama, who was so convinced about kindness, right? And one time, just having to, very privileged being in his presence, and the forum was education and Dharma education, and he just said 2 simple things. One thing he said was, affection is natural to human beings. And it was really strange what happened in my mind, because it took this really sardonic attitude. It was like, oh, really? Sure. You know, like, okay. You know, in your mind. You know, you have people around you all the time that are being kind, I'm sure. But, I mean, that I'm dramatizing it. It wasn't quite like that. It was just more really that sense of, like, I didn't know that. That's not what I experience. Is that right? Well, the Dalai Lama said it. I'll keep it in mind. And yet, at the same time, at an intuitive level, I had glimpsed that this is so, and I had known, and I have known, how connected we are in kindness. But what he said was that it is natural to who we are. And so with this experiment of beginning to counter the lie that the mind tells us about not having time and slowing down to be able to embody in the time that does exist, with this receptivity to kindness, there really are times when it is absolutely clear and true, which has turned, there's this wonderful reference to or response to the Buddha's Desanas and some of the suttas where, and I won't go through the whole thing, but it's as if something that was upside down was turned upright. And something got completely turned around. And that sense that, yes, kindness is something that exists within all beings. So, there's a woman at Whole Foods I'm sort of working on. Because when I go there sometimes to get a coffee, she's really kind of, I don't know what that is, kind of mysterious to me. So I was just kind of standing back and watching her one day, and she started smiling at coworkers and so forth, and I thought, you know, not completely and totally impervious. And I began to see, okay, you know, a kind of fluidity and so forth. I began to see it. I gave myself a chance to see it. And I came out of a hardness and a fear of her. I didn't know it was fear, but, you know, we discover along the way. And now that I've seen this in her, she's really sweet to me. She calls me honey. Hi, honey. Here's your coffee. You know, and all it was a shift in my mind in terms of how I viewed her. And it just took a little bit of time, to use the experience of standing in line, not waiting, but really observing, to see the kindness and for the mind to recognize it and for us to see it reflected in one another. And now I'm honey. Is that a good name for me? You know, and it's just such an interesting process. We do not have time to go into how noble kindness is related as well to something very, very profoundly poignant, which is forgiveness. I will only say that will be a part. I'm not trying to tease you to come to the retreat, but it will be a part of the reflection there, because kindness isn't something that gives way immediately to forgiveness. But kindness allows for us to recognize the truth that in truth, no one would truly harm another being. In truth. That when that which is turned upside down is turned upright, and when we begin to see clearly, we begin to see that in our inherent tenderness and in our inherent purity of intentionality, in truth, no one would harm another. And that when that begins to become clear, that kindness is natural, and that the overlay of reactivity that arises out of such states such as restlessness, avoidance of, you know, existential pain, anger, and ill will, which is the mind state that Metta addresses, as well as fear, that we begin to see actually what it is that does cause harm. Not the person, not the being, but the confusion that arises out of the lack of mindfulness, the lack of patience, and the lack of kindness in life. So honoring time, perhaps this is a good time to pause. And I'd like to just suggest that we call the power of patience, or we invite it into a few moments of mindfulness. And in doing so, the possibility of inviting into our lives. Because after all, this moment, this breath, that's sitting here, this is our life.